Welcome to the Gifters Podcast. I'm your host, Christopher Kai. This podcast is sponsored by the GPS Online Program, which teaches you how to turn your story into a successful speaking and online coaching business. For more information, go to christopherkai.com. Our guest today is Arif Harbat. He is a digital transformation leader, CTO, startup advisor, as well as an author. Arif, thank you so much for being on our show today.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I was looking at you and researching your profile on web and your website, and you have done so many phenomenal things. But before we dive into your working with a company like Lloyd's, which manages $900 million in assets, or having some kind of mafia story in Hungary, let's talk about how you grew up, any influences you had that really started giving you an inkling that you had some level of ambition.
I think one of my earliest memories and the things that shaped me the most when I was growing up was playing tennis. I started playing tennis at age 4. My mum is ethnically Indian, but was born in Tanzania, Africa. And if you know much about that culture, she found a free tennis course for me to play age 4. Never played tennis. No one in the family played tennis. And she was like, well, it's free. You're going to play tennis. And so off I went, played tennis. I thought it was all right. But I kept getting more and more free coaching because the coaches thought I had ability. So my mom was like, well, go play more tennis. You play more tennis, it's free. And over the few years, I got a genuine passion and interest in tennis, and I became obsessed with it. It became everything. I wanted to be a professional tennis player from about age 5. My whole childhood was built around playing tennis. And I did actually go on to become a professional tennis player. In fact, I didn't do my undergraduate degree. That's how obsessed I was with playing tennis. So I traveled the world with my bag and my rackets, and off I went to pursue my dreams.
Wow. I don't know if people realize this, Arif, but like tennis is one of the most grueling sports in the world, because I was reading the autobiography of Andre Agassi. He's one of the top tennis players in the world. And it talks about how, I don't think people realize, so when you have football in the US or basketball, those aren't all year round. You can rest. Whereas tennis, it is all year round, and it's one of the most punishing and grueling sports in the world. So for you as a young person, how did you deal with that? Because it's not just, oh yeah, we have a season. No, the season is global and the season is around the world. So how do you even deal with that as a kid, where it's consistency, it's constant?
I think it just becomes part of your kind of routine more than anything. I think you get used to it. I think you, when you're a child, you can almost get used to anything. And I just got used to the cadence of waking up, training before school, going to school, coming back, training at weekends, going to tournaments during my holidays, when my friends would go out on a weekend, I would be playing tennis. I think it just becomes a bit of a routine. And I think that's really important, because what it instilled in me was a really deep sense of discipline, which I think is really important. And it really instilled in me that you have to focus on the fundamentals. If you focus on the fundamentals, then you see improvements, and that constant looking for the 1%. I mean, I don't improve very often, but if you can get those 1% improvements at the end of the year, it can make a huge difference. So that from a young age, having that discipline, I think made a very big difference in my early life.
Yeah. And I was actually a big fan of tennis. I'm from New York City, so I'd always watch the US Open. And whenever the best players, again, this is at the time of the Pete Sampras's of the world, but their level of precision, detail, preciseness, as you were saying, it's that little inch or even half of an inch, because they always have that replay of that ball hitting the line or not. But in terms of that precision, has that helped you in your career and in your mindset? Because ultimately, it's all about that decisiveness of decision-making.
I think so. I think it's looking at everything that you have available to you, and knowing that effort alone is not enough. I mean, I put in an awful lot of effort, and I made a decent level. I got to about 500 in the world, but I never made the top stream, even though I probably put in as much effort as anyone else. But I think it's that knowing which tools to use at what time. It's knowing that in the really crunch moments, making the big decisions in the crunch moments when it really matters. I think that's the difference between success and failure in high level sport. And you can see those players who are just elite. They just know when to pull the trigger and when not to.
Let's talk about some of the experiences. I mean, how many tours did you go on, or how many matches do you think you, because you're like a rock star, frankly, in the tennis world. So like if you're a basketball player, yeah, you stay in the US, maybe Canada, but you're in the UK, right? So I'm curious, tell us some of these stories, whether fun stories, crazy stories about your tennis world.
Well, I traveled mostly around Europe. So I traveled to Spain, France, Croatia, Hungary, all around those kind of Eastern European countries. And two stories really stick out to me, which I actually tell my children. They think it's hilarious. One time I was traveling from Croatia to another kind of area of Eastern Europe, and I was told I didn't need a visa. And so there was this two countries that were had been at civil war for quite a long time. And there's this one man, 1 mile no man's land. So between the borders. So I leave Croatia and I go towards what was then Yugoslavia. And I get to this checkpoint and these soldiers get on the onto the bus. They look at everyone's papers and they don't speak any English, but they point at me and they kind of go off the bus. And so I have to get off the bus and then the bus leaves. And so I'm at this checkpoint with armed guards, like pointing their
guns. By yourself?
Yeah, by myself. I'm traveling by myself with all my bags, my kit. I was carrying like, I don't know, 50 pounds worth of kit. And they were like, you need to go back that way. So I have to walk 1 mile back across no man's land with these people with guns and my shoulders are bleeding. I'm crying. I don't know where I am. I don't know what's going on. And then off the back of that, I regrouped on the other side of the border and I went on to win my first ATP ranking points.
And so how old were you at the time?
I was 18.
So let's just hold on that point, because again, a lot of people have struggles and challenges and obstacles. What were you thinking when someone pulls you off this bus and you're like, oh, I'm going to die? Like, what are you thinking in your mind? I'm curious.
Not that I was going to die. I didn't think they were going to kill me, but I knew I was in trouble and I didn't know what it was. Like, did they think I was carrying something illegal? I just didn't know. So there's this kind of obviously overwhelming fear, but then the mind goes to, what do I need to do here? How do I survive? How do I get through this? And to get through it, it was, you need to walk a mile back across the no man's land with all your bags, not knowing where you are, not speaking a word of the language. So that was tough.
I didn't even know that you had to work a mile. I mean, like, I'm like clueless when I'm on a bus or whatever. I'm just like, oh, I'm daydreaming. So how did you actually knew that it was a mile like back? Like, you actually have a good sense of direction?
Roughly. I mean, there's one road because it's between kind of two border checkpoints. So it was just one road out. But yeah, it was scary. But I think things like that you remember and you draw on in the dark times. Yeah. You can say, you know what, I've done this before, I've got through tough times, and it gives you like a self-confidence that you can kind of draw on in the dark times, and obviously an interesting story to tell at dinner parties.
Yeah, it's kind of like when people say, if you're ignorant and you don't know, you just do it anyway. I remember when I was 19 years old, I was an active student leadership role in the University of Buffalo. And my friend and I, we actually rented a U-Haul. We had four buses that we chartered to take students from Buffalo, the university, back to New York City, where we're from. Mm-hmm. We literally made money from renting charter buses where we had 50 people on each bus. We literally had a touring service, essentially 200 people that paid us money. But since they had luggage to bring back, Johnny and I were both 19 years old at the time. We rented a U-Haul and him and I packed this truck up and we drove a 15-foot long U-Haul with luggage from 200 people back to New York City from Buffalo. We're 19. And just thinking how ridiculous and audacious that is. But again, going back to your story, that really tells you and the people that are listening and watching how important it is to have these just experiences. So that's one story. You mentioned there's another story that you share with your kids as well.
Yeah, it was towards the end of my tennis career, actually. I was playing tennis in Hungary. It was just myself and my coach traveling. We were on the stadium court. So it's not a huge stadium, probably a few hundred people. And my coach is sat there, obviously incredibly partisan crowd. I'm playing in Hungary. I'm playing against the Hungarian. Obviously, every time I hit the ball, booing and they're shouting. And I'm kind of sit there at the change of ends, just kind of gathering my thoughts. It's a pretty close match. And these four stretch limos arrive. I was like, oh, okay, what's going on here? And like 30 huge burly men get out of these cars, which I didn't really know who they were at the time, but you can kind of guess, like some kind of mafia section. And they sat, all of them sat right near my coach, like 15 either side of him, huge men. And they kind of take their shirts off and you can see like scars, knife marks and bullet holes. And they kind of say to my coach, your man need to lose. And so my coach comes running over to me, says, you need to lose this match. They're telling you to lose this match. I said, I'm not losing this match. And so we play on and I start to win. And my coach is getting even more, I'm so young and stupid at this, that I didn't really understand what was going on. And my coach comes back to me, he says, you need to lose this match. I said, I'm not going to lose. And I end up winning this match, not realizing the kind of the situation that my coach was in. And obviously nothing bad happened. It was just intimidation.
But that's again, not obvious though. I mean, to be honest, you know.
I was pretty young and stupid. I didn't really appreciate it. And obviously now I'm older and I'm a father. I probably would have done something a little bit different. But as an 18-year-old hophead, just doggedly focused on winning and being successful, that was just like, no, I don't accept this. I'm going to win.
Yeah. Let's talk about how, again, you didn't go to university, you're a professional tennis player, and now you're technologies. How did you make that pivot or the transformation in yourself?
Yeah, I was on tour, and a friend of mine, I think we were in Spain, and a friend of mine had a laptop, and he was towards the end of his career. He wasn't really enjoying tennis anymore, and he'd started coding. He was coding PHP, I took one look at it, and I went, what's that? And my brain is very mathematical. I love math at school. Love physics, chemistry, those kind of more logical subjects. And from that point on, I was just hooked. I was like, that's what I want to do for the rest of my life. I want to do, I don't really know what it is, but that's what I want to do. I just kind of completely fell in love with coding and technology. I've never had any interest in technology before that. And literally a flip went, and I said, right, I'm no longer a tennis player. I'm going to be a coder, and I'm going to write software, and I'm going to be a technologist. Literally overnight when I was about 19 years old.
And then how did you get into the world? Because now you're a CTO, you've built a bunch of companies. I mean, again, it's one thing to say, yeah, I'm obsessed, but a lot of people are obsessed, but you literally built companies and exited companies. So talk to us about that journey.
I think I've always had a very entrepreneurial spirit. I mean, even when I was at school, so I don't know, 13, 14 years old, I would buy sweets and crisps from a kind of local shop, and I would take them to school and I would sell them for a margin. So I'd buy them for 10p, I'd sell them for 20p. In fact, sometimes I remember actually selling my lunch to make some money. And my mum and dad thought it was hilarious, because obviously coming from an Indian mother, she was very much like school and business, and these are very important things. So she really built that entrepreneurial spirit in me. So I always knew I was very entrepreneurial. So when I left the tennis world, I knew I didn't want to go into a big corporate yet. And I founded a number of companies, I think 7 companies in total, mostly around building technology. This is kind of pre-dot-com boom. Some of them were epic failures, just kind of on the bandwagon, and I learned a lot from those. But one was actually moderately successful, pretty successful, which I sold. So I was about this point, 29 years old, sold a business, I played tennis, and I was looking at my life going, my first son was just about to be born. And I had a bit of a midlife crisis. I was like, what do I want to do with my life? And I could kind of hear my mum and my dad saying, well, you didn't finish your schooling. And so I decided to go back and do an MBA. And that was the real pivot point in my career, because that was me really grounding out my business knowledge. At that point, I was a deep technologist. But as you kind of know, you may well know, technologists talking to business people at the boardroom, it doesn't always work. And so I really thought I could take my entrepreneurial spirit, this new business skills that I'd been given, and merge that with technology and kind of bring those together. And that was the kind of next 10 years of my career.
Yeah, and again, I looked at some of your profiles. I mean, you work with the UK government and Lloyds. I mean, Lloyds, I think it's what, a $900 million in assets. So talk to us about some of these more high level things that you can teach some of our users and listeners and viewers. How do you get to that scale and level?
Yeah, I mean, Lloyds Banking Group is the one of the biggest banks in the UK, 900 billion of assets under management, 4 billion in revenue. So I think that was the first job I'd done up before, kind of post my startup career. And it was a big adjustment going from startups into a very big corporate, 150,000 people. It was a very big adjustment for me, but I really liked it. I really liked having a big team around me. I realized that was a big, in startup world, it's quite lonely. You can have quite small teams. Here you can have 30, 40, 100 people. Some of my teams I've led over 1,000 people in my career so far. So having that team around me aligned to a mission was really, really great. So I worked at Lloyds Banking Group for just over a year. Then I went to Morrisons, which we can talk about a little bit later, launched their online business, one of the biggest grocers in the UK. Then I went to the largest wholesaler in the UK, Booker Group, which is now part of Tesco, ran their online business. And then, as you mentioned, had an incredible role working for the UK government, which I'm happy to talk about.
Yeah, so you have all this experience, and I know you decided to write a book. So talk to us about this book and why you chose to write it.
The book was... it was on my bucket list. I've always wanted to write a book. It's never been the right time, children or family or work or whatever. So I thought, right, now's the time to write a book. Little did I know that it would take me 5 years to write. It's a really hard endeavor. And what the book was, it was the codification of over $1 billion worth of transformation that I've done across my career, because a lot of transformations fail. And that's, it's just money down the drain. And I wanted to help transformation succeed to build a better world for future generations. The more transformations that succeed, the better the world will be, in my belief anyway. So we tried to codify how to run transformation successfully. And we have a framework around it, which we've been used many times and helped lead and run many successful transformations now. It was an incredible experience.
Well, dive into more of the book, because again, when you talk about transformation, what does that really mean for yourself, your company, your businesses, your clients?
It's a very misunderstood term. It's very overused as well, I think incorrectly. For me, a transformation is a large scale change program initiated due to a dissatisfaction in current business results that has a positive material impact on enterprise value. That's a very fancy way of saying it's a big program that you do because you don't like the results of your company. And at the end of it, your company should be worth more than it is today. That's basically how I define it.
Awesome. So like, again, let read your book. I mean, is it like a 200 page book, a 300 page book? I mean, what are some of the specific practical advice that, let's say for myself, I am not a technology person. I literally tell people, yes, I created online training programs. I have clients in 120 cities and 30 countries, 6 continents, but I have had times where I'm on a podcast interview and my laptop goes blank. And I'm like, what happened? And it's like, because I didn't have it plugged in properly, right? So I am like the least technology person in the world. So if you share your thoughts and advice, I get the whole transformation thing, but what are some practical things that business owners, clients that have learned from you, what are some things that they can learn from your book and some of the really core, as you said, codification lessons?
I think a focus on value as opposed to a focus on busyness. I think one of the first things we see is when we go into a company and have a look at their transformation is we say to them, why are you doing this? What objective are you trying to solve? And I've worked with companies that have spent 50 million on their transformation and they can't answer that question. So of course they're going to fail because they don't know where they're going. And it sounds so absurdly obvious, but time and time again, companies don't sit down and go, why are we doing this? Are we looking to take a whole load of cost out? Are we looking to increase our revenue, launch a new product, enter a new market? What is it we're trying to achieve? And then have a ruthless attention to the value that that might deliver. So if you've got a choice of 5 projects, you pick the ones that have the biggest value towards that outcome. I mean, it's, again, sounds really obvious, but it's very rarely done. And having the metrics in place to be able to see, it's like steering a boat, right? If I blindfold you and put you underneath the deck, your boat is probably going to crash into a rock. But if you're on top deck, you've got a compass, sat nav, you've got really clear hold of the wheel, you're probably going to navigate the glaciers and not go down like the Titanic. So it's that kind of analogy. You have to have the telemetry in place. You have to have that clear statement of value.
So 2 stories I want to dive more into. So one is about the UK government and the other one is about, was it Morrissey or Morrison? Yeah, so talk to us about U.S. government, because I remember doing a State Department entrepreneur program where they invited executives in the U.S. to train and coach entrepreneurs in the Middle East. And it was just a very prestigious program to be a part of, and you're literally changing countries, literally. So in your case, you work with the U.K. government. Talk to us about that.
It was the most interesting and best job I've ever had. I think working in government, it was the only time I felt comfortable talking about my job around my family and around my friends. It was the only time they were actually interested in one of my jobs.
Why is that?
I think because you're talking about the machinery of government, how decisions are made, how policy is done. You have a direct influence. You're meeting people. Like I met Theresa May, who went on to be our kind of prime minister. I met Michael Gove, who obviously he was my minister at the time in the Ministry of Justice. Who obviously very influential in government. These are the people that people know. They're on paper, they're in TV, and I worked with him, I met him. I actually presented to him on multiple occasions. People are really interested in that. They're interested in how their country works. I think when you can kind of give a little bit of a knowledge and give a bit of color to that, it's really important. I think the thing about government was, it was the scale. I had over £1 billion worth of budget, a team of over 1,000 people, and that's huge. I could affect people's lives. If you did your technology job well, you could change the lives of citizens, because working in the justice system, which is where I was working at the time, Ministry of Justice, it's very high stress. People don't come into the justice system because they want to, right? They come in because they've committed a crime, or a loved one has committed a crime, or something bad has happened to them. And if you can make their life a little bit easier through technology, then you felt a really strong social mission. And I think that's what I loved about it. A huge collective of people with a very strong social mission trying to change the world for the better. It was a privilege to be there.
No, it's great that you say it in that way, Arif, because at least in the US, unfortunately with government, a lot of times they see it, oh, government. It's not always a good thing to say, but I love how really governments, when done right, can affect such massive change. And how long were you working there for?
2.5 years.
Wow. Yeah. And then you talked about, is it called Morrison or Morrissey?
Morrison's. Morrison's is one of the biggest groceries chains in the UK. I was brought in, I worked there when they'd spent about 120 years as a physical retailer. So they had big stores, big shops, but the world was changing. This was 5-6 years ago. The world was changing. A lot of the competitors were going online. You could do your grocery shopping online, and they had no online presence. So I was part of the team that worked on the technology side of bringing their business online into the 21st century. And it was a true testament to what you can do when the CEO and the board are aligned on a single mission and you are given the kind of leeway to get things done. And this is a big company, right? I mean, it's over 100,000 people. And in 1 year, just 1 year, they managed to completely reinvent their business and go from a single channel, i.e. physical stores, to an online retailer. Where most of the competitors had taken 3-4 years to do it. We did it in a year. The team was incredible, obviously, but the leadership was just phenomenal. And it really shows what you can do when there's a real will and there's real motivation to get something done.
Well, so that story sounds amazing, but a lot of people, they're set in their own ways. And for instance, in the US, you had Kodak and it went nowhere, or Blockbuster. When you have these changes, now you have Netflix, which is a behemoth. But I'm curious, were you involved with the communications with the C-level executives to say, it's not easy when you say 120 years. Mm. Like I used to work for Marketing Express. They've been around for 170 years. But what they did really well is they always are understanding that they actually started as it was like a Pony Express service where they're doing mail. Because again, 170 years, this is back in the 1800s. Mm. And every single time they'd pivot. Most people see them as a credit card company, but they do a lot of other things as well. So for you, tell us about how you're able to convince, persuade, work with someone that's a bold move that they did. So even though you, as the transformational digital leader, know that's what they need, but how did you go about communicating with them and how important this was for them?
I think that's the role of having a very high level CTO in your organization. I think they are the ones that should be scanning the landscape. They should be understanding the trends and competitive threats. I think that's incredibly important. I think the biggest thing is to show them how it's going to affect either their livelihood, their job, their metrics, their results. And the way we did it is we just showed them where the market was going. And you can get so much evidence to say, look, if you just stay in one channel, your revenue will be capped at this level, but this is the size of the online market. Do you want to play in that market or not? Because if you don't, then you're going to be capped at this level forevermore. And by the way, look at how your competitors are growing in all of these areas. So there is a little bit of fear that you have to instill. But I think having a team that is absolutely galvanized around a single mission. And one brilliant thing about that business was on the day we launched the Morrison's business, the online business, we all went up to Dordon, the fulfillment center, huge fulfillment center up in Birmingham, which is a city north of in the Midlands of the UK. And all the senior team at 6 o'clock in the morning, we all went out to deliver groceries to the first customers. It was a huge deal. We went out onto the parking lot where hundreds of these grocery vans were sat ready to deliver customers. And as I walked up to my delivery van, this huge yellow delivery van packed full of groceries for our customers, I get closer and closer. And I see on the side of the van, it's got my name. It says Arif. And I was like, what's going on here? And all the senior team had their names on the side of their van, and all the vans had been named after the senior team. And as I got into the driver's, well, not the driver's seat, but next to the driver, there was a plaque on the van that said in contribution of Arif Harbert's contribution towards launching the Morrison's online business. And that, I often see this van going up and down the M1, which is a big road in the UK. It was just a really special moment and just amazing leadership to kind of get that done.
And it's also very telling too, because again, not all companies, not all clients actually give credit to the people that actually have done that. But for them to even praise you publicly, that's phenomenal. And I'm sure your mother is quite happy. I mean, do you get free food from Morrison now as well?
Yeah, we do go to Morrison's a lot. It's a great business. Yeah. Mom's very happy. Free food. She's always happy.
And how long did you actually work with them for?
A year and a half. just to launch the business.
Wow. See, it's interesting because you talked about the UK government 2.5 years, you talked to Morrison's a year and a half. It doesn't necessarily take a long time. I was actually telling you prior to this interview where I was talking to Ram Shriram. He is one of the first investors at Google. He's still on their board. He's one of the founding members of Google. He also worked at Amazon in the late 90s with Jeff Bezos. He actually introduced Jeff Bezos to Sergey Brin and Larry Page. But he said something that you're telling me now through action, where it's not a coincidence that him as a billionaire, you as a working with billionaire company, is that he talks about when you're online, when you're global, when you're online, you're immediately global. And there's no real scaling yet because you literally have to just figure things out. But like I said, 120 years, 1.5 years, that's the power of your expertise, RF. That's the power of what you do, because unfortunately, a lot of people that are stuck in their ways, 120 years, just imagine literally the baggage, the mindset, the patterns, but in 1.5 years, you can literally transform it because, as Ram said, who literally is one of the founding board members of, it's no longer called Google, it's called Alphabet. But there's a reason why he's there and he has this direction, because it is about that immediacy of intellect, intention, and implementation. And you do that quite well. So I love the background you have there, where you have all these models. I mean, can you share a story about that to really kind of end our interview? Because it's like you're essentially like a Tony Stark's, where you have the technology side, you're fun, you have these crazy stories about mafia. I think Tony was working with some mafia or trying to, like, you know, he's this hero. So you have this element of that where you're a great storyteller, but you also have this depth of technology. And so, since you have all these cool models, talk to us about one of those models to end their interview, because I think our listeners would really want to learn and hear about that.
Yeah, I mean, Lego is a big part of my life. I've been doing it for a long time. Thankfully, my children also love Lego. We spend most Christmas days doing Lego for hours on end. Oh, wow. If I had to pick one, you could probably see the Millennium Falcon. Any Star Wars fans out there? I think that's probably the one that I kind of resonate with the most. You have Han Solo, you have Chewbacca, and they have this piece of technology, the ship, that people always underestimate because it looks old, it looks tired, but they consistently, time again, through kind of skill, wit, ingenuity, luck, they always win the race, they always get it going, they always kind of get through the adversity. And I really like that analogy, because it's very rare you walk into a business that has brand spanking new technology and everything's perfect and new. There's a lot of old stuff. I mean, you just have to deal with it, and making that run really well, getting it through, winning the race, going through kind of adversity with your technology and really making it work for you. Actually seeing the possibilities. Han Solo always saw different angles through than kind of other people. And that's what I really resonate with. And I think technology getting you through, making the world a better place, more sustainable, better businesses, growth. I think that's what I aspire to.
Awesome. RF, thank you so much for being on our show today. I love your story. I love your inspiration. And thank you so much. And I'll definitely check out your book. Have a great day.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Gifters Podcast. If you want to learn how to turn your story into a successful speaking and online coaching business, go to christopherkai.com to learn more.